Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we're the cracked experts on pop culture films that have surfaced in the last 3 to 4 decades.
Self-appointed, but
here we are. We're here to tell you about things you may or may not know about your favorite classics and offer observation as what might ruin the movie for you. It's up to you.
But we hope it ruins it in a way that also enhances it, I hope.
We hope.
So it'll be a love-hate thing that you have with this movie afterwards.
For the next 45, 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting the following film, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, 1981, directed by Steven Spielberg. Along with us is our guest, Dan Van Kirk, who is the 2016 Comedy Central comic to watch, narrator of Dumb People Town and Hindsight podcasts on iTunes. Definitely watch his sketch show DVK on the Nerdist channel. Before we begin, Dan, if you want to say anything about yourself, now's the time.
I'm really happy to be here. Yeah. I love this movie. I can't wait to dig into it with you guys. I find that over time it's changed. Like as a child, it was predominantly, if that's even the right way to say it, it was like more scary to me than anything.
I can see that.
And then
over time,
like I've come to like, now I'm at a point where I'm like, oh, I see how this is an homage to everything. So I'm thrilled to be here.
When was the first time you watched it, when you were like really little?
Yeah, probably like somewhere around 5 or 6 maybe on the old VCR.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, Indiana Jones is
got horrifying moments.
Oh yeah, no, that scene with the angels when it turns into a death face.
Oh my god,
that used to scare the shit out of me.
I remember that scaring the hell out of me.
Not to mention the skeleton wall.
Oh yeah, that comes out of nowhere.
And then a snake just.
You know what really left an impression on me? The hot poker.
Yeah.
With that like Fraulein. And like taking the hot That guy scared me to death.
That guy was horrible. And then, like his terrible hands.
Did he ever go on to do anything else that like is of any note?
I think he wasn't even really an actor, if I remember correctly.
No,
really?
He just crawled back into his cave.
Or like he was like an actor that hadn't done it in a while or something. I remember some interesting story about that guy. He's apparently like a very sweet man, but he just really got into this toady, like
he was like a precursor to
he's
Shemmy.
Sweaty.
Yeah, he's very sweaty. I don't know if they like misted him before every shot.
And he like predated Harry Potter with like this like Slytherin speech that he had. That was like, yes, Fraulein.
Yeah.
He creeped me out. You know, he still creeps me out. That holds up.
Man could definitely talk to snakes. That guy.
Well, let's kick it right off. Before we begin, Dan, can you give us a synopsis of the film to the best of your ability?
Yeah, he seems to get a lot of support from one man, but I would almost say like a nearing disgraced college professor.
Nice.
Moonlights as an artifact hunter and then gets roped into a government program for which he has no clearance or seems to have any concrete questions about, other than like, you're going to give this to me when it's done. I'm like, sure.
They do give him zero support.
Like the government has this huge thing and they send one guy with no training.
Yeah.
It's right
He's got a whip.
They don't even give him like a special passport.
Right.
Or like a plane ticket.
No.
They give James Bond like gadgets.
Yes. They give him a car.
It's like right up there with Ben Affleck breaking down like why they wanted drillers instead of astronauts for Armageddon. We can't just get anybody to drill a hole. We need these guys.
Yeah. But Michael Bay said, shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Shut up and take this check. So yeah, then he gets sent off to go do this, and through the help of some international friends of his, accomplishes his goals, I would say.
I think that's a great
summary. Fairly good summary.
Yeah.
We like on this show to segue to terrible log lines or summaries of movies that we thought could both be true and a horrid one-liner for the movie. Basically, synopses that would never be used by Hollywood. We've prepared a few for these in a segment we like to call Terrible Log Lines. Take us away.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, a college professor reconnects with a teenager he seduced.
Ooh. I like that. Maniac attempts to place proof of God into a museum.
Raging alcoholic gets thrown into madcap caper with ex-boyfriend. She drinks so much.
Entirely too much.
Yeah.
She drinks an impossible amount.
Like she's 100 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Along those lines, drunken professor burns down Nepal's only bar.
I like it.
Whipmaster fights Arab and African communities.
Ooh. Man proves you can wear fedora and have whip skills and have it all.
French Nazi travels to an exotic island and explodes.
Archaeologist misweighs sand and almost dies for it.
Oh, the movie that shows you can wrap a whip around anything and never need to get it back.
Hero mechanic gives his life defending his airplane.
Aww.
The U.S. government itemizes newfound magic. I think that's good enough for us for now. Right?
They do just kind of catalog it.
Yeah. That's good.
It's like a Radio Shack distribution warehouse back there.
No one knows where those are either.
Probably literally where they're keeping it. Nobody's ever going to break into this building. Nope. It has a Radio Shack logo on the front.
Now we know the plot. Let's dive into the making of a movie from pre-production to post-production in a segment we call Expensive Pretending.
Expensive Pretending. Costs a lot of money to
make believe.
Oh,
I actually
want to
take the floor on this one because one of my favorite facts about this movie is the creation of it. Because George Lucas was trying to hide away from his enormous Star Wars success and vacations in Hawaii, right? Mm-hmm. Guess who's there on break from Close Encounters? Stevie Spielman. So, as one does, they're building a sandcastle. I shit you not, this is real. They are building a sandcastle together.
How high were they?
On the beach.
Who knows? Fucking
who knows?
High.
It was the late 70s.
They're both just fucking rolling and building a sandcastle. Yeah.
Lucas mentions
what
that
if
he...
we live in this castle, man? Like, well, who says it? That a sandcastle has to be small, man? Like, we could build our own structure.
I don't know, man. Sand is, like, coarse.
And it gets everywhere.
It gets everywhere.
So's life. Though, man, we're living in life.
Like, write that down,
so
dude.
Lucas mentions that he's had this idea for like a decade about, quote, the adventures of Indiana Smith.
What?
Yes. And in my mind, which is this is all speculative, but in my mind, that sandcastle meeting ended with Spielberg walking away a la Justin Timberlake and Social Network, turning to Lucas and saying, lose the Smith. Jones.
Yeah.
I like Jones. That's all. That's
yes
all.
Or no? Hand to God, guys. If it was Smith, do you think then the nickname would have been Smitty?
Maybe.
You know what I mean? Like, because he loves doing that sort of thing.
Yeah. Man,
Chewbacca is chewy. Like, he loves doing that.
Yeah, you're right.
It would have been Smitty.
Smitty. Yeah. With a whip and a Smitty. It's actually really funny.
That really sounds like a guy who works at a state fair.
Well, it's also because we work with Alex Schmidt, who we've all called Schmitty
one
time or another. And now I'm imagining Alex Schmidt with
get him a whip.
Just give him a whip. See what the fuck happens.
You want to add anything on the pre-production element?
Yeah, I mean, this is like peak George Lucas. Mm. This is like he was the king of Hollywood at this point. He had more clout than anyone, certainly more than Spielberg, because Spielberg was coming off of 1941, which had disappointed people.
Right.
So like he wasn't the sure thing hit maker that he is, but Lucas was, and he had all this juice. So he kind of just used that to kind of will this movie into existence. And it was based like mostly on a single lobby card still shot of a Zorro movie called Zorro Rides Again. And it's a shot of Zorro jumping from his horse onto this truck. And that exact shot is in Raiders in Indiana.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like he rides up next to it on a horse and then jumps onto the truck. And he's like, this picture is the movie that I want. This scene, I want this in there. This just is, it captures it fully.
Right. Indiana Smith.
Of Indiana Smith. And then how the movie came together is he and Spielberg and Lawrence Kasdan, the screenwriter, who was also just kind of up and coming at the time, just had a series of meetings over the course of 1 week, I think, where they just sat a tape recorder in the middle of the room and it's just Spielberg and Lucas just spitballing ideas and Kasdan sitting there like writing it all down. And at the end of that meeting, they're like, okay, go write this.
There's a transcript online, in fact.
Yeah, you can read the transcript of all the recordings that they made.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty dope.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And also just like hear how they work, like what ideas came to them in what order.
Yeah,
and
they're pretty like bombastic. Like they finish each other's sentences. There doesn't seem to be like a code, if I remember, of like you speak, I speak, you speak, I speak.
Yeah. Whatever you may think of either one of those guys, it seems like a genuine collaboration.
That's cool.
Yeah. Which is cool.
Yeah.
And I always thought, because Spielberg always talked about it, he wanted to make an ode to B serials, a la like Flash Gordon, and he always wanted to make something like James Bond. So that was something that Spielberg was like super, I'm down. Which I thought is interesting at this time because he's like, he wants to bring in the spark of like that American frontiersman spirit that we saw in Han Solo.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to turn into literally James Bond. He wanted both an outlaw and like a lawman, frankly. Like a guy who could jump between both.
Indiana Jones is never in legal trouble.
No.
And he really should be.
He should be.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He has a whip.
Well, I mean, and what he's doing is like breaking international laws.
Yeah,
like
he
goes into these places and steals things from graves.
He also seems to have a questionable relationship with at least one of his students.
Yeah, 10,000%. Right? Yeah. Like, that's, I mean,
she
clear.
Wrote "Love You." On it was there was no question mark.
Oh, that lady, yeah.
Yeah, there was no question mark. Like, she was saying it.
Apparently there was a scene where when Marcus comes to his house.
Oh, I read that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where that student was there with him.
The same one?
I don't know if it was that student,
because
it was like
a
young
female.
Because
if you watch the movie, you're like, why the hell is he wearing this robe? And then two, why is their champagne already open?
he was just
like, I really thought
himself.
That. And then I ended up finding out that there was that like deleted scene of the guy leaves and then he's there with a woman.
Yeah.
But he didn't want her to be a playboy or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. That was like they wanted him to be.
Hence the James Bond.
Yeah, like that was part of it.
They really wanted him to be that.
Lucas's archetype. Original vision was that he wanted him to be more of like he had some kind of habit that he had to support. So he was kind of more of a like a darker character in the original conception.
Which is totally like a new thing for then. But now it is inhabited like all of our heroes.
Sure.
Like think about like everyone's from here to Die Hard to Star-Lord. Yeah. They're all like playboy philanthropists. They're all like got a dark streak, but they're also good guys at their heart.
It's always like a charmingly roguish dark
which
streak.
Is
it's never like genuine darkness.
Yeah. It's, like, yeah. It's not Joker darkness.
Like Star-Lord's not sitting in the back of the Milano, which is the name of his spaceship, like shooting up space heroin.
Like, I hope so.
Yeah, right. Which that might be why he's bombing around stealing Infinity Stones. He's gonna buy that sweet, sweet H.
One of the things that I loved about this movie too, and it's something that like we've gotten like so obsessed with now, with like what we see in our movies and our culture, is we feel like they always have to explain the origin in every movie. Mm-hmm. Like you look at when they redid the Grinch. There's like a third of that movie is like how the Grinch became the Grinch, and then like in X-Men First Class, like well, we've got to show you like everybody is a little kid, which is even predating them. How they became the X-Men, which is its own origin story. But, like, we go all the way back to, like, Mystique at 7 years old.
Right.
And stuff like that. This movie, you just jump in. This guy's going through the jungle looking for something.
Right.
And we don't need to tell you everything. I mean, obviously, we were all given the gift of young Indiana Jones.
Right.
R.I.P. River Phoenix. But I just love these deals where the movie just says, like, the audience will figure it out.
Yeah,
this guy's the good guy, this guy's the bad guy. We don't need to tell you everything about how we got here.
You understand
the kind of
him,
things he does.
You understand him completely within the first 10 minutes of the movie. You're like, okay, I know this guy. I know what he's about. And like you were saying with James Bond, it's the same kind of thing where it's like, we don't need to explain him. You just see him for a scene, and you're like, okay, I get this guy.
And the format is the same. Like, the first 10 minutes, 6 minutes of any James Bond film is him on last mission, closing the deal. And then we jump into, all right, now he's got to meet with M.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Maybe fans of the show can, like, tell us after this drops, but... In the pre-production stuff, did you guys find out anything about Harrison Ford's casting? It's interesting to me that it seems like, you know, he wanted to be done with Star Wars, spoiler alert. And so he just kind of was over the Han Solo character or over maybe the whole thing. But he seems to still like Indiana Jones a little too much.
Really, that's actually a really interesting point.
You want to talk about
Tom Selleck? Sure, yeah. I'd love to go into the casting. The casting of this movie is fascinating. From the beginning, Spielberg wanted Harrison Ford, and George Lucas was against it for two reasons. One, he didn't want Harrison Ford to be his guy. Like, he didn't want to have like a Scorsese type, like where he's just in all of his movies. And two, he was like, the deal that they had made for the Indiana Jones movies, which was like an unprecedented deal at the time. They were like asking for all this money up front. They also wanted like merchandising rights, and they also wanted to own the movie. So
George?
Yeah.
George and Steven.
When they were trying to sell Raiders, they were selling it as like a 3-picture deal, and the studio who bought it essentially would get like distribution rights, but Lucasfilm would still own it and would own all the merchandise and anything. It was like at the time it was unheard of. Like you can find old pictures of Variety write-ups of being like, look at these jackasses, who do they think?
But this is part and parcel for Spielberg. He's known as like one of the staunchest negotiators of all time in the industry.
Oh really?
Yeah. He was the one who was like, I got points on the back end.
Yeah.
Also merchandising is just me. Like, he was really good about it.
And Lucas famously did that for Star Wars, too. He was like, I want all the action figures. And I'm like, fucking fine. But because it was a 3-picture deal, he was like, I don't want Harrison, because he never got Harrison Ford to sign to more than one Star Wars. He had to go to him each time to ask him to do it, because Harrison wouldn't sign a multi-Star Wars deal.
That hard to play and get Carpenter motherfucker.
He was like, nah, we'll talk about it when the next one rolls around. But so they went through this big casting process. It was neat. The way that they did the casting process was Spielberg would have people come down to the Lucasfilm headquarters, which was this building called the Egg Building because it used to be like an old egg packaging plant or something.
Where?
Around here.
I think it was Burbank.
Burbank, oh, okay. Probably. Yeah. But they called it the egg building because they didn't want to call it Lucasfilm, because at the time it was like Star Wars was everybody, and they'd have like, I mean, now like nobody cares. Like, we probably work in the same building as Lucasfilm.
You guys, I saw George on my way in. He's still like consulting. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Disney owns it. But
we got a ranch out in the back.
Yeah, yeah, all right. Yeah, he was getting grapes.
He's in the kitchen getting goldfish. But the way they were doing the casting was they were trying out different indies and different Marions, and Spielberg would have them come in and go to the kitchen of the egg building and make a recipe together. Mm. Like, that's how he would audition them together.
Chemistry test.
Right.
Which is kind of smart. Like, really smart.
Yeah. You learn a lot about people trying to do something together, do anything together.
Yeah. They had the standard, like, reads and stuff where they would just come in and audition like the parts, but like this was like the big test, was he would bring them in to try them out together to see how they would perform and stuff like that. And one of the early front runners for Indiana Jones, which I think some people may are, it was Tom Selleck. He wasn't Magnum PI at the time, though. He wasn't famous yet, so this was like poised to be like his big break, because he was in a development deal with CBS or whoever had CBS. But they were kind of sitting on it. Like, they weren't putting Magnum into production. So he's like, fuck it, I'll just audition for this movie. And they got to the point where they were casting him, and then CBS was like, nope, we're putting this into production now, you can't have him. So they moved Magnum P.I. in production so they wouldn't lose him.
A lot of people don't know is when actors go, or writers and stuff like that, if you have a project, you have a thing called position. So you have like first position and second position. And when you negotiate any sort of deal, you negotiate what position that falls into. And that takes precedent. So if you're, I'm trying to think right now of like somebody who's on like guest spots on like an HBO show, but still, oh, here's one. So Tim Meadows was in Goldbergs, right? And then he also had his show Son of Zorn. Well, Son of Zorn is in first position. So any of his production or anything he does, that comes first. And Goldbergs, if they wanted to put him in, have to work around Zorn.
Right.
So in this scenario, Tom Selleck, his deal had first position on anything that he did scheduling wise, and then they have the right by that contract to be like, no, you can't. We're gonna shoot. We're gonna go into production on something. Right. And that's essentially what you're saying happened to him, is exactly he had first position deal with CBS and they didn't give a shit about or they just gave so much of a shit of not losing him that it forced their hand into
But ironically, it's Indiana Jones was still his big break, because almost being cast in Indiana Jones caused Magnum P.I. to go into production, which is what blew Tom Selleck up. So.
And do you guys know this? There's a lot of hat talk because it's in Indiana Jones. I recently listened to this interview about a person who had like written a book on the history of hats and like how hats, you're wearing a hat right now. If you go back before, like in the 70s, early 80s, hats were never worn as a fashion statement. Other than like men with fedoras and things like that. But baseball caps were never worn. You would see them on the occasional child or mechanic, but that was it. And so this person tried to trace back how did hats become, like baseball hats become part of men's fashion. And it all goes back to Magnum P.I.
No fucking way.
Yeah. That started the idea of the cool, a guy socially being cool wearing a baseball hat.
And now it's...
And very tiny shorts.
Yes. Every sports star.
Everything. Is Magnum P.I.
We so gotta do like.
This is really a story about hats.
Is it haberdashery? What is the art of hats?
Yeah, I think that sounds right.
We gotta do a deep dive on making of hats.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're just important in my life. Like, my style is I've never
seen you without a hat.
Exactly.
It's usually this one. Magnum P.I. not getting cast in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Man, I want to grow a mustache.
You did. Just shave everything else.
There's a mustache hiding in there.
In this area, I'm a 13-year-old boy.
So, I think it looks good.
I need the beard. The beard carries it across the finish line.
I'm an unapologetic neck beard. I go for like the deviant/hobo look.
That needs to be your Twitter bio. Unapologetic neckbeard. Yeah.
That's pretty solid.
So he ends up moving on, and then they settle on Harrison.
They settle on Harrison, yeah. They came to him, you know, they finally went through so many people. David Hasselhoff was another person.
Really?
Because he was, this is also, I think this is before Knight Rider. So he hadn't
So if you didn't get
either.
Indiana Jones, you got an extremely successful 1980s television career.
Basically, yeah.
Nice. Yeah. It worked out for everybody.
Well, yeah, I feel like they were casting based off like hairiness of chest.
It was all about how hirsute.
Well, I think it plays into what they wanted in that. I mean, because this is a super homage to the matinees of like the 50s and
Macho.
Yeah, and they just wanted a big barrel-chested guy, which honestly, I feel like Harrison's actually a little bit more of a slimmer build.
Yeah,
than
he's not
two.
Like a he's yeah, not like a, yeah. a big guy. Yeah,
I mean, he's got muscles, but he's a roguish.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
All of the
he's
know,
not he's
Han
not
Solo.
He's not like Tom Selleck or Hasselhoff.
No.
They're just like
we're like barbarians.
Yeah, yeah. Gigantic hairy chests with legs. So yeah, they finally just came to him with the deal, even though Lucas is like, he's never going to sign it. He's never to agree to multiple pictures. And Harrison Ford meets with Spielberg because he hadn't met him at the time. Like they, I think they maybe casually knew each other, but they hadn't worked on anything together and they hadn't really interacted in a professional way. But he does a meeting with them and he's like, all right, I'll sign for 3 movies with you.
Really?
Just out of character. Because
he must have loved the character. Right?
Yeah, I think he liked the character. I think he probably liked Spielberg a lot.
Yeah, I think Spielberg has that effect. Oh, plus, there's something to be said about Han Solo isn't the lead. So that might not be why he signed on to multiple. But knowing that he was the lead, he knew once he's inside, he could control things. Because it would be like Temple of Doom comes around and he's like, what are you going to get another?
Who else are you going to get to play Indiana Jones?
You know, I ask you guys, like, might be the dumbest question you get in any of these
throw
episodes.
Throw it out there.
Is Temple of Doom a prequel?
Yes, it is.
It sure is. Yeah.
I never knew this.
Yes?
Yeah.
I never. So I heard someone offhandedly say this like 2 weeks ago or so before you guys even reached out to me to do the show. It was a radio show that I listened to out of Chicago. And I was like, did I just hear him say it's a prequel?
Yeah.
I never, ever knew that.
It's like a stealth prequel. Because if you don't read the date at the very beginning or if you just kind of like don't think about it, you would never realize it.
Why?
I actually have a theory. No. I got a theory about it. Like, it's, I think it wasn't out of like they wanted it to be. I think it's just that once they realized that they had the Nazi arc between the two other movies, and they always knew they were going to do like a Last Crusade, I think.
Right.
They had already planned out the concept.
Yeah.
Kasdan was like, but if we were to follow that trajectory, all that Temple Doom, like the Shanghai stuff, that wouldn't fall in the right time because of World War II.
Right.
So they had to make it earlier.
How much earlier is it?
It's like 27. No, I don't know.
I can't remember because Raiders
maybe
is
like
31.
7 years earlier.
Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's in the 20s.
Definitely not before he was apparently fucking
teenager. Teenage Marion.
Karen Allen.
Yeah.
Just like because she's what? 25 in that movie.
Maybe she references, when they're
in the submarine, she's like, you're not the man you used to be 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's like,
ooh, that's
so
dark.
Fucking a 14-year-old Indy.
All right.
I mean, he was in his mansion.
She's 28. Let's give him a three-year-old hope.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
I think that's what they're thinking.
Sorry to totally derail, but
that's a good question.
I didn't know that probably until I was in my 20s.
And if I ask questions where I seem dumb, I definitely want them to be into a microphone.
Absolutely. That's, if I do something, it's been my mantra for decades now. If I do something dumb, I at least want people to see it.
Yeah,
like
for sure.
If I fall down the stairs, I at least want to have somebody be able to.
You got that right. That's always the first thing you say.
Yeah. Speaking of Marion, the people that they were close to casting for that were Deborah Winger, Sean Young, and Dee Wallace.
Dee Wallace is crazy to me.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
That's a weird
Dee
one.
Wallace
yeah.
is the mom from E.T., right? She's eventually in E.T., and then also The Howling. Oh, and this is my last piece on the casting, and then we can move on. This is my favorite piece. Is they cast John Rhys Davies as Sala, obviously. Mm-hmm. Their first choice was Danny DeVito.
Danny!
No!
And they couldn't get him because he was too expensive.
Oh, baby! Really?
Yeah, Danny DeVito priced them out.
He gave him the old DeVito.
Because I think he's a big TV star at the time. He's on Taxi
huge,
at the time.
Yeah.
So like, that's a good call.
So he was
that's like the biggest
star they were reaching for.
Right.
And
what a
like,
different time.
Like, now. Yeah. I'm on Taxi.
I also want to just notable thoughts about we're still in like the pre-production era. Not about casting, but like something that's unique to my knowledge or just like something that people might find interesting is this was not one of the first movies, but definitely one of the movies that utilized a certain property of camera lenses that they used in this movie, which are Panavision cameras.
Oh, yeah.
Panavision was shooting into, like, I can't even remember when it started, but like 45.
There's a lot of Westerns.
But this one used in few notable shots. There's something unique to anamorphic lenses, which is what Panavision uses. It makes this horizontal blue flare when there's a like a light. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's been
in a bunch of movies.
Yeah.
But this movie kind of, it's known in like film schools as like the one that like there's a few money shots for it that it just after this movie just took flood across the industry. In fact, due to this movie's success, like other studios started utilizing it, like Warner Brothers and stuff. And they tried to make sure that even though they weren't using Panavision glass, that they were trying to recreate this thing to the point that they actually made a piece of glass, like a filter that you put in front of the camera that artificially creates the blue flare.
Yeah. What's an example of a shot in Raiders where you can see that?
You can see it when he's digging, or he's not digging, after he's done digging and all of his servants are digging, I guess. And it's like the...
Yeah. Oh, it's the dusk shot where he's dusk putting shot. On his hat.
Yeah, he's putting on his hat. You get a little bit of that. You get it in the Well of Souls, which is the snake pit. At one point, it like rears around because of the reflections are like the reflections between the glasses happening, and it just camera dollies through it, and it just turns like almost all blue for a minute or a second, and then it moves past. So there's a few shots of it. If you can think of any other shots in the audience, please mention them.
If you or a close family member take daily medications, pay close attention. Chances are you've gotten the chain drugstore runaround, you know, long lines, having to make multiple trips, chasing doctors and insurance companies. You know, sometimes you get there, you have some prescription hasn't got in yet. You know, somebody's got to call somebody else, and it ends up taking up a whole bunch of time. Enter Fill, the smarter prescription refill service. Your monthly medications are filled by top-rated, locally owned pharmacies and delivered to your door for free. All you have to do is take a minute to sign up on their website. Your prescriptions arrive month after month to your door on time. If you run out of refills or if there's a hiccup with your insurance, they troubleshoot everything, so you don't have to. Your copays remain the same. You don't pay a dime in shipping, and they accept most insurance plans. And the best part is you'd be supporting a locally owned pharmacy that prides itself in serving you. To sign up, go to fill.us/club and give them a try. That's Phil, like the person, like Bill Murray's character in Groundhog Day, .us/club. And they'll even take $20 off your first prescription refill, which is pretty good deal. That'd cover, I think, at least one or two of my prescriptions. So, and if you're not 100% satisfied, they'll gladly switch you back to your old pharmacy. Phil, the smarter way to refill your prescriptions.
Let's talk about production, right?
Well, yeah, well, speaking of the snake pit, all the snakes are non-venomous except for the cobras. They had like a couple cobras in there. And in order to have cobras, you know, for safety reasons, anytime you have a venomous animal, you got to have anti-venom. And they're filming this in Tunisia, I think.
Yeah.
They could not find any anti-venom like in the entire continent.
Mm-mm.
None in Europe. They couldn't find any in Europe. They had some flown in from, eventually they had some from flown in from the American embassy in India.
Feels that, like it should be more readily available.
You're right. Like, yeah, they had.
Yeah, anti-venom.
And when they did get that anti-venom, which they had got from like a naval hospital through the American embassy, it was like old. It was like expired. Oh, so it was like they couldn't find any fucking anti-venom.
And two notes about the snakes. One is that the production bought, just think about this. They brought 7,000 snakes. That is probably the worst phrase that I'm going to utter for the next 3 years.
That's a weird shopping list to give somebody to.
7,000
snakes. Give some
PA. No, like, there were pythons, cobras were the venomous ones, but they're mostly non-venomous legless lizards, which I didn't know is not a thing you call a snake.
Me either.
Yeah, there's legless lizards, apparently.
Really?
Yes. And they bought them.
What's the
almost 7,000?
What's the distinction?
I don't know. I'm not a biologist.
Probably.
I'm not lizard man.
Bone structure, I'm guessing.
It's got to be something. I don't know, but that's what I read.
Herpetologist, is that a reptile?
Yes, man.
I don't know.
I'd love that you didn't even look at me. Like, who would argue with you on that term? Be like, actually, sir, it's the, whatever you want to say it is, I'm going to agree with
reptiliologist.
You.
Reptiliologist.
I'm looking at you now. Now I'm teeing you up. Now's your moment to shine.
But in order to...
Tell me what the fuck a reptile doctor is.
I believe you.
More in this cobra anti-venom vein, the two shots that happen, one, it happens with Marion, one, it happens with Indy, is that when they fall into the Well of Souls and they look and there's that same fucking cobra there, there is plexiglass between the snakes and the actor.
So, for obvious reasons.
Now, if you watch the, if you ever watched it like on the VHS or on film, you can actually see, like, because there's fires, you can see reflections of the fire in the plexiglass. They removed it for the DVD because they're not improve it?
What about the laser disc?
I don't know. I think
they
put
it's still on the laser disc.
Radars instead of guns in there. Yeah.
All the Nazis have walkie-talkies.
Walkie-talkies, yeah.
Instead of machine guns.
That shit's getting out of hand.
Obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but I know that one of the more famous behind-the-scenes stories about Indiana Jones, this first one, is that everybody was like really super sick for the desert stuff. And that's why that famous scene where Indy's in the streets of Cairo, I think is where they're supposed to be, looking for Marion, and he comes across that swordsman who does like this cool thing, and he's just like fucking just shoots him and then goes off. They had a whole fight scene choreographed for that they actually filmed part of. Like, you can kind of see behind Indy, there's this like meat stand, like a butcher stand behind him, and they had a whole fight scene that involved like the guy coming at him and like on that butcher block and like hitting meat instead of him, and he's like rolling out of the way, and they film part of it so you can actually see some of it that exists. But on the day, like, everybody had been so like violently ill, like they had crew
dysentery
members
and
dysentery. I mean, it was like 130 degree heat. They had people who were literally collapsing on set and had to be flown to hospitals. Like, that's how bad it was. And Spielberg was like, he wasn't ill, but he was like losing his mind at this point. He was like, this shoot is horrible. I'm done. I just want to leave.
John Rhys Davies actually shit himself.
Solid shit his pants.
I shit myself.
I shit myself.
Start singing HMS Pinafore.
My friend, could you hand me a towel?
Stop the gate. Stop the camera.
Please, my friends.
Please, Salah.
We all want to do a pooping joke.
Yeah, poop jokes.
It's fun to do John Rhys Davies poop in his pants. In his booming theatrical voice.
Yeah, so theatrical.
His Falstaff voice.
So what do they end up doing?
Well, on the day of, because Spielberg's ready to shut the whole thing down, Harrison Ford's sick as hell. Everybody's sick. And they still had to kind of iron out this scene and get the rest of it, which would involve a lot of like rolling around. And obviously Harrison Ford doesn't want to shit his pants. Mm-hmm. So he's like, well, what if I just shoot him? So they filmed that.
It worked.
And classic.
And it's like a classic scene.
Yeah.
In fact, they almost did a redo in Temple of Doom, which is technically a prequel.
Yes.
Which makes that
It not make sense.
Not good.
Yeah.
I think it was Joss Whedon who had an argument about how, like, the fact that they did the repeat of, like, he goes for the gun but doesn't have the gun in Temple of Doom means that this is not just a thing where he was just literally tired in Raiders and, like, just decided. It means he does this often. So it's like he's a dishonorable human.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Well,
he's like,
that.
Let's have this fight. He's like, I'm just going to shoot you like I did the other six guys who were, like, big sword.
But I kind of like that about him, where he's just I'm just going to shoot him.
Yeah.
He kills so many people.
Yeah, he just does not
for
give
a college
fuck.
Professor?
Something I want to talk about is at the beginning of the movie, unless you had more.
Okay, no, cool. You're good.
At the beginning of the movie, I had this huge question, and I want to see if either of you guys can solve it. So at the beginning of the movie, Indy tells Alfred Molina, just within minutes.
His guide, Satipo.
Yeah. He's like, when entering the ruins, the first trap that we're going to see is a trap based on light. Specifically, if light is obstructed, spikes will come out.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, let's think about that for just a second. Does that mean that somehow, like, whoever created this ruins, they attuned it to the light at the moment of the time of day? Or is it just those spikes come out every night? Or
it's just every time the sun
like
goes down,
winter
it just
and
fills
summer
up
solstice?
With spikes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how does this thing freaking work?
Yeah, I don't know. Who's reloading it?
No, yeah. All good questions, right?
Yeah, these are all perfect questions.
Audience, if you have an
this
answer,
is my only
I
thing
desperately want to know.
That I don't even know how you would create this mechanism, but if the light changes gradual enough, they don't shoot off. It's when there's a sudden break of the light. That's the only way that would work.
I could see that.
Because it's so gradual over day that it just kind of like eases off the trigger.
Right.
But if you break the light suddenly, then they'll...
But what happens
but if
when
you get
like
there at
night,
you wouldn't have that problem at all, right?
Question is how old? Yeah, because it would
and
be
there's
gradual
no light for you to break.
But my question is, how old are these ruins, and how fast do plants grow? Because we know that there's like plants just going all around that.
I mean,
window.
I think you just either maybe on purpose or inadvertently created like a great Funny or Die sketch about the people who do upkeep on booby traps.
On booby traps, yeah. Yeah. They have,
like,
to do.
Yeah, upkeep. They have to, like, go in.
Like, all right, team.
Yeah.
We got to make this obscure chest be hidden.
You know, it's well tread, the construction workers on the Death Star. Right. You could be the guy, like, the crew that upkeeps booby traps, like, for years. You have, like, 3,000-year contracts with, like, old Mayan temples to, like, go in and make sure
we gotta maintain these secret puzzle rooms.
Yes. I like the idea that, like, there's a hierarchy there because there's obviously a foreman, and one of the lower-end guys is gonna be like, hey, boss, what do you think about just stealing the treasure?
Yeah. Because you know? I wanted this, too. Like, even with the boulder, I'm like, who resets this boulder?
And this is weird. Like, the boulder, I think, is meant to seal the temple up.
Right. If you're on the inside, like, you're done.
Why let anybody in the first place? Because it's not like a place of worship, because you can't navigate that place to get to that idol without getting assassinated.
By definition, like, there's one way in.
Yeah.
One way out.
So, like, they just put it there to, like, entice people, and then the first time somebody tries to steal it, they got a boulder that closes it up forever. So it's like they knew it was kind of like a game show when they built it.
The boulder just happens, right?
It happens once he takes the idol off and tries to...
The weight.
So it started moving the moment he did that, but he got to the point where he could get in front of it in time.
Well,
That's my question.
It comes
from above.
Does it? Yeah.
It comes from above.
But it must have started moving the moment that he...
Right.
Like, whatever set that off had to have happened then, because he doesn't set off something right before the boulder that initiates the boulder.
No, you hear a mechanism slowly engage. So he's got, like, a little bit, but then, like, you don't see the boulder until after he gets double-crossed by Alfred Molina and has to, like, struggle up, and then, like, the door, there's another door that's, like, closing.
Yeah.
So he gets beyond that. Yeah, you're right. It's like, where was that coming from? Like, did it take it, like, a minute to roll to that point where he finally sees it?
It must be, like, off like, to just the a, like, side.
A giant slide coming down the mountain.
And it, like, the slow mechanism is just, like, gate lowering.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the mechanism. It's just those maintenance dudes. Just like they heard something. Oh, we got to push the rock now. Finally, who knew?
Dave, help me with the rock! There's a whole side story where they had an argument. Yeah. Like, it should have gone right away.
Dave, is it enough sand? Yeah. No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Like, I cannot do this by myself.
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts, though, from the Disneyland ride, that boulder.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, dude.
And the arrows. Oh, yeah. Man.
It's solid.
Amen. Speaking about faulty entrances and exits, that's a segue for you.
Sure.
I love how when Marion and Indy get out of the snake pit, they just, like, push a block of limestone. Do you remember this part?
Yes. Before the airplane? I was having a very hard time figuring out the levels.
Yeah.
Because they
the
were
layout
down,
of
up, down. Yeah.
And now they're up, like...
So they must have had
and
stairs.
And now it's, like, all of a sudden, like, a pyramid that's above ground.
It's a loose limestone block that can be pushed by the strength of a man.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just archaeologists, like, fucking everywhere. By the way, there's a plane tarmac kind of
airfield. Yeah, they're within 50
like,
yards,
yeah,
right? At 100 least.
Meters, yeah. And, man, that's not the first thing you check is, like, let's just go to fucking town on this limestone
structure
and
right
dig
next
in
to
there.
Their secret plane. Because
this will lead to something.
Yeah.
Probably the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah,
the
thing we're here.
The thing we're looking for.
But no one does it. You also notice the sleepy, like, airman in the wide shot when he's, like, it's, like, foreground the propeller,
uh-huh,
and it's looking at them exit. And it's because it's a deleted scene where as he, like, gets right out of the limestone, like, crevice that he made, there's an airman right in front of him, and he knocks him the fuck out.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but... Otherwise, because I always noticed it when I was a kid, when you watch that shot, it's very short, but, like, there's just a sleeping dude, like, right next to Indy,
just...
like, pushing this huge block and then getting out with his girlfriend.
I thought he was just taking a nap.
And he's just, like, napping, I guess.
Let's not say girlfriend. Let's pull it back.
Okay.
I think Indiana Jones would want you to maybe... we've reconnected.
Yeah.
We're going to see what happens. We're not putting any labels
on it. Let's
see
where it goes.
Yeah.
We're never putting any labels
Travelers with benefits.
Yeah, for sure, you know? This is just like a fling. We're on an archaeological fling.
I'm jumping forward a little bit.
Sure.
In the interest of time. But one of the craziest facts that I found while researching this is that the Nazi submarine that interrupts Indy and Marion are on their voyage.
Yeah. That never goes underwater?
Yeah.
Nope.
The Nazi submarine that takes them over, that's fucking Das Boot. Literally.
Really?
The same shit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Whoa.
It's actually, in the 80s, they like sold all their shit away and they like rented it from Das Boot.
Yeah, it
which
really
is just a crazy thing.
It really drove me nuts that that submarine never submerged.
There's a deleted scene where you can see him like clinging to like the periscope or whatever the entire way, just like holding onto it. Like,
which makes no sense. From all standpoints.
No. Yeah. None at all.
Just like, just some
do you
time.
Think it was just like a like production schedule thing that they didn't want to like have a scene where he found a hatch before and like stowed away really quick?
I honestly think it's the cost of submerging.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the idea that if you have a boat, that is a lot more cost beneficial than a submarine.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it could have been not a functioning
submarine.
It
drove me nuts that they drove all the way to that island or whatever.
Yeah, just like coasting on
As an aside, there's that one scene on the ship where Karen Allen and Ford are doing their love thing, right? Getting back to that.
Yeah.
That was all improvised. So all of this, like, where does it hurt? Here, here, here.
Yeah.
That's all Ford and Allen. That's crazy.
That's from them. That's those chemistry meetings. Them making recipes together.
Making some eggs.
In the egg building.
Those Cornish hens.
Yeah.
That they made.
All their artisanal pizzas that they made.
I'm telling you, 30 years, this is going to be huge.
Just make the pizza. Just make the pizza.
Yeah, the end sequence with the Ark, when they open the Ark and all the crazy shit that comes out. In the script, it just says, like, all hell breaks loose. So they didn't have, like, a conception for that. And that's most great. Of that design came from Joe Johnston, who is a director. He would go on to direct Captain America.
October Sky.
Also Jurassic Park 3, but we won't hold that against him. But, like, yeah, he came up with, like, the sketches of, like, the Ark ghosts. Also, like, the lightning that came out and, like, melted people. So, like, a lot of what that end sequence looks like came from sketches that Joe Johnston drew. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and I think that brings us into the post. Because
that
was one of the biggest post concerns is how to do
is how to make the ghosts. Yeah.
You want to speak to that?
Yeah, sure. The ghosts were actually silk puppets that they put in water. Because they wanted to give it the sort of movement that they have, that, like, ethereal movement. They couldn't quite figure out how to get it right with actual puppets, so they just submerged them, and rather than move the puppets themselves, they would just move the water in the tank, so it would make their
pretty smart
their ghost bodies float.
Yeah.
Those creepy face meltings hold up too.
Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah,
they're amazing, and that's like a time lapse with a hairdryer, I think.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Wow.
It's like wax and
it's like
paper mache.
I forget what the material was, but it's just they just did a time lapse filming of melting that dude's face with a hairdryer.
Except for Bullock.
Belloc,
who's just head explodes.
His head blows the shit apart.
And goes into Nazi soldiers, which is awesome.
I always wondered, maybe I missed it, but how does Indiana Jones know all you have to do is close your eyes?
That's
an amazing question.
In fact, Brett, he mentioned the very same thing. Now I have the answer for you. There is a deleted scene where the Imam warns Indian Salah about the dangers of the Ark. If anyone touches the Ark, they will die. And if anyone looks at the Ark when it's open, they will die.
The Iman is the really old guy they go to talk to when he tells them that the reading on the other side of the medallion, when they figure out that the staff is too long, he's that really old guy.
So it's a plot hole that's never mentioned. A plot hole that I think that no one ever mentions, but is like pretty gaping in terms of like how things happen. When Belloc captures Indy in the Well of Souls, he also captures Salah. So why is Salah free?
Yeah, I was wondering that too.
Yeah, there you go. Well, there's a deleted scene where one of the Nazi soldiers says to another Nazi soldier, kill that guy. And the soldier, they have a moment and he pities him and he lets him free.
Oh.
So that's why they...
Also, that was that's the scene where John Rhys-Davies shit his pants.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
So he got free because he shit himself.
He shit all over himself.
But good question.
Yeah.
Good question, my man. I want to talk about Ben Burtt just because there's a few interesting things about him. So Ben Burtt is a guy who did the sound design, and he got an Academy Award for it. He did Star Wars. He was like crushing it on a major
scale.
Yeah,
he's the guy that made up like
and there's
the
a few kind
of
inventive creating of some sounds being sound design. For example, the Ark opening is just the sound of the lifting of the upper tank of the toilet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My favorite in the movie is that the snakes in the Well of Souls has mixed in fingers running through cheese casserole.
That's just gross.
That sounds delicious.
He's a fucking...
I don't think I've ever had a cheese casserole.
I know, that was weird. It was very detailed. The sound of the ghosts when they come out of the Ark are mixes of dolphins and sea lions screaming.
Oh.
Yeah, and those are those were sounds that Ben Burtt had made for the original Alien for Ridley Scott that they wound up not using.
Wow. He's a fucking national icon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the boulder is him putting a station wagon in neutral and rolling it down a hill and then leaning out the back and recording the sound of the tires going over gravel.
And this is the guy who created lightsabers.
Yeah, the lightsaber
noises. He's also the sound of WALL-E. He's one of the greatest, like, Jesus, this guy has impacted my life sonically across the board. Like, he's done so many movies, and he created the sound that when an arrow hits a tree, it makes a... That's a ruler on a disk.
Yeah.
And then there has to be an award named after him, right?
There should be.
I mean, he got a special achievement award for sound effects editing, too, for this film.
The category didn't exist yet, right?
It didn't exist yet, and they were like, this shit is real.
Sort of like special effects didn't exist until American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it got a special award, and then after that movie, that category existed.
In fact, the Raiders was nominated for 8 Academy Awards in 1982.
Is that the only one it won?
No, it won 4. It was included in Best Picture, or it won 5, sorry. It got art direction, film editing, sound, visual effects, and like we said, the Special Achievement Award for sound effects editing, which really didn't exist yet.
Wow.
But let it sink in that it didn't win for best score. Granted, it was the same year as Chariots of Fire.
One last interesting thing, because you just mentioned the score, that made me think. John Williams, who did the score for the movie, had actually written 2 different themes, and he brought them to Steven Spielberg and was like, which one do you want to use? And he's like, well, just use them both. So the 2 themes he did were the main one, like bum, 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 and then like the kind of interlude.
Yeah.
Those were 2 different themes he had written, and they just combined them together to make one.
I love that.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
Just like, let's go both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, killing it, Johnny W.
What up, J-Dub? Rolling in here with them 2 teamers. Them 2 teams.
Yeah. Yeah, baby. Let's go make the sandcastle.
Comes in and dunks on him.
He first spent 1:43 dragging a hoop into the room. This is going to pay off, man. Hold on, give me a second.
Brings it in, just laboriously drags in a trampoline.
Yeah, trampoline.
It's going to be a trick shot. It's amazing. You're going to love it.
You hold this gorilla mask, I'm going to wear it.
Exactly. Do you have anything else you want to talk about marketing or release? All right. That's how the movie was made. So let's now get into some observations in a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things.
In this one, we're going to talk about symbolism like you didn't notice. As our After Hours mentioned, Marion is basically a teenager when she first met.
Late teens.
So to be blunt, he reunites with an early 20-something 10 years later. So he basically had sex with a 14-year-old.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of mentioned one of my observations as well. She's clearly a terrible alcoholic. Like, she can drink a 200-pound... I don't know if it's a man or woman, and I don't want
to
be...
Sure. Like, yeah, what? We don't have to gender. We don't have to gender subscribe. Yeah.
Drinks that person under the table, and I bet she, 100 pounds?
Yeah.
115?
Yeah, and then she's like, fine.
Yeah, that's not how livers work.
Fine.
And then continues to drink throughout that scene, which that scene in the bar in Nepal was the first gunfight Steven Spielberg filmed.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting.
And that great shot of it, for a second, you think Indy thinks that he got shot.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then later when she does the same thing to Belloc, drinks him out of the table, and then like stumbles out completely into the blazing desert heat.
Yeah. Like, no dehydration whatsoever.
No. Like, she would be so...
She's
like
a tank.
Yeah.
She's a fucking tank.
She's that friend, like, you go like on like some French trip and everybody's just feeling horrible the next morning and they're like, I've been up since 8, guys.
Let's do it.
I'm ready to go. Yeah, and you're like, can you just slow it down?
Yeah. It's like, Marion's like,
no. Some of us are busy getting old.
Yeah. It's like in between shots, she's just chewing handfuls of Tylenol.
Must be.
What else is hidden?
There's a couple of fun, in the Well of Souls, when Indy and Sol are lifting the arc out, you can see C-3PO and R2-D2 on one of the hieroglyphs.
For real?
Yeah. It's kind of funny, like, Lucas and Spielberg used to cram those sons of bitches into, like, every movie they did. Like, I think R2-D2, you can see him in E.T. somewhere. In the end of Goonies, when the pirate ship breaks free and sails off, they're, like, on the deck of the ship.
Really?
Like, they just, like, liked to keep reminding people. It's like, hey, remember, we did Star Wars.
Yeah, no one's gonna forget.
You didn't. We did. Yeah.
And something Tom wrote in addition, which I love, is that the guy who played the mechanic is actually in the film twice. The gigantic guy who fights Indian Marion's bar,
mm-hmm.
and then He's also in two...
The gigantic mechanic who fights him in front of the plane.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I like to think of that guy as Tom Hardy's dad from Bronson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because he looks exactly like him.
Yeah, he does.
He's also in two other movies, the original trilogy as well.
Yeah, he shows up in Temple of Doom as the head of the guards who gets like smashed by that rock smashing machine.
Really?
Yeah, and then he's briefly in Last Crusade walking up to the blimp that Sean Connery and Harrison Ford are on. They were supposed to have a fight scene, but it got cut. So he was like going to be like the same, I guess it's like the same family.
He's basically Jaws from Bond, right?
Yeah.
He's just this reoccurring.
Are him and Harrison Ford the only two actors that appear in all three films?
Ooh.
Yes.
Wow. I think the first three, I guess, because there is four.
Yeah, there are four.
We keep forgetting.
Yeah.
He had a three-picture deal, man.
Yeah. He's like the Murdoch of this series.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, MacGyver, Murdoch kept dying but would come back. Yeah. That's this guy.
Like, I'm other Murdoch.
I really, really nailed that reference for everyone. They're really going to really gonna dig that Murdoch reference.
All right, we're going to segue into a segment that talks about scenes that would have enhanced or ruined the plot in a sequence we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed.
I want to know about that fucking monkey. I want to see the story of that Nazi monkey.
And that guy.
Yeah, like, who is he?
The motorcycle guy that owned the monkey. And, like, they had a whole, like,
they had
he could look at him and be like, I'm going to stay there.
Yeah.
And the monkey would be like, oh, I got you, bro. No, I got you now. I'll hang tight for a while. I'll see you later, though.
Yeah. This was not their first shady operation. Like, these guys were
first dealing with Nazis.
Yeah.
Because my question is, like, was this Egyptian monkey taught a Nazi salute by osmosis, or did like a Nazi sit him down and be like, hey monkey, this is how you greet us? Like,
or did motorcycle guy tell him, look, these guys are Nazis, so if we want to get paid, you got to do the hand thing? And the monkey's like, word, I got it.
That makes sense, but that's like such a level of communication of like, okay, so they think, we think, you know, like there's
they're in sync.
The scene I wanted was motorcycle guy finding out monkey died. And him.
We never see him again. He's going to be devastated. Because that's like.
Bad dates.
Well, that's like if
that's
he never.
That's a bad date there.
If that's a bad date.
If he never found the lamp, that's Aladdin and Abu.
Oh, you're breaking my heart.
They just continued their life of petty street crime to survive. Yeah. And then they eventually.
He's not going to be a prince at the end of the story.
No, he's going to be burying that dead monkey.
Can you imagine? He's like, he came over and was like, hello, my friend. My monkey was last seen right here with you guys. I don't, I was wondering if maybe I could get him back. Wolf. My friend, let me tell you something very sad.
Do you think Sala buried the monkey?
Sit with me. Now, we've already had a funeral, but we can dig him up if you would like. Like, just the whole, like, what do you mean?
Because I never...
He's gone. And then that guy has, like, his whole life changes. Oh, motorcycle man.
I want to see the sequel.
That whole thing. Because like, they didn't know the monkey was evil.
Dude, the so next Indiana Jones should be Motorcycle Man, like, getting his vengeance on Indy.
Yeah.
Even though he didn't do it, but he just
knows.
He blames Indiana Jones for monkey's death.
Right.
And he's been waiting all these years to, like, get his revenge.
And he does it via, like, poison dates.
Yeah, it's gotta be, you know, for sure. Like,
it has to be.
An eye for an eye.
Oh, man. Oh, there has to be fanfic about that guy.
Has
to be, right?
I don't even know his name, but it's fucking great.
This eye patch motorcycle dude. He had a whole thing going on.
Dude, that's the coolest.
He had a whole thing.
Like, I want that description.
He knew what was up.
Like, Fedora Whipmaster.
Yeah. Eye patch motorcycle dude.
Shining a light to eye patch Michael's motorcycle dude with a monkey.
Yeah. Monkey henchman.
He's like a bizarro version of Ross from Friends.
Oh, man. Yeah, he is kind of. I'm just wondering if they buried the monkey because they didn't know he was evil, or if they just like threw him in the garbage.
That's kind of what, I mean, what I feel like
anything,
do?
Yeah, anything could go there.
Yeah, right.
Probably bury him in the sand.
Yeah, sure.
Let nature take him back from whence he came.
Yeah, that's a scene I want, is motorcycle guy finding out that
his monkey's dead. Yeah.
So now we watch the movie, and now we'd like to make some observations that you may or may not have heard. Basically, any weird, non-intuitive arguments about things in the movie. We're calling this segment, Let's Overthink It.
Yeah, let's think way too hard about this movie.
Yeah.
Okay, so at the end of the movie, the arc gets brought back, the government confiscates it and throws it in the Radio Shack warehouse, and we never get to see it again. And Indy and Marcus are, like, livid about it. They're both like, no, we should be able to study it. Like, you won't tell us anything that's about it. It needs to be before a team of scientists and dissected and, like, really, like, they're adamant that the Ark needs to be, like, studied and like examined really thoroughly. And it's like, he forgot what happened the previous scene. Like, the only reason Indiana Jones is like there to argue that he should look at the Ark is because he didn't look at the Ark when they opened it.
At one point, I think on the steps says they don't know what they have.
They don't know what they have. Yeah. It's like, yeah, but you know what they have. So you like should know that they're probably doing the best thing they can, which is like fucking hiding it.
Not like a single archaeologist putting it in a museum. Like, they're doing the most responsible thing you can do to basically a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah.
Which is just hide it away and forget about it.
And yeah, like, you know, this is like a magic box full of ghost murder. Yeah. Like, don't, what do you mean research? Like, what are you going to do?
You're going to open it is what you're going to do.
Whole movie, before he leaves, like, Marcus is like, this is like nothing you've ever gone after before. Like, he keeps warning them about how like severe it is. And then Sala warns him about how severe it is. And then like the Amon warns them. And then like, it's just like, the current of the whole movie is like, this was not meant for the world of men. It's not meant to be fucked with. And the Nazis are just carelessly using it because they don't respect its power. And then he's like, not, that's like where they go back to. It's like not respecting its power.
When you go back to that scene, he's got like a chip on his shoulder. And we as the audience like agree
are with him. Yeah.
Yeah. When they say like top men and he's like, who? And they're like, top men, which is probably the most responsible thing that that man can be answering, because he's like, if I were to tell you who it was, that is like a security breach.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to tell anyone who is on it, quote unquote. Why? Because it's a murder box.
Yeah. It's a box of ghost murder.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's just, let's hide that and, never talk about it again. We shouldn't have dug it up in the first place,
USA,
but we did.
USA. Yeah.
We did it to keep it from the Nazis.
Yeah.
Like I think that's the undercurrent. Like what makes us not be mad at Indiana Jones for grave robbing is there's always a worse person trying to take the same object.
Absolutely.
So we want him to get it, so the bad person doesn't get it. That's the only reason we're not like, oh, he's just stealing things from other cultures. Exactly. So this is an early observation we made on Cracked, and I'm not saying we invented it, but it was like the first kind of this type of observation that we started doing on the website. And that's basically, if Indiana Jones had stayed home and done nothing, the outcome of the film would have been the same. Like, the Nazis still would have found the Ark, they still would have taken it to that island and opened it, and they still would have all exploded with god magic.
Or would they have ever found it?
They might. I feel.
Oh, because they would have had the.
They know where it is enough time.
Hand, which also creeped me out when I was a kid.
Right, because they would have presumably would have got the medallion from Marion, because Indy isn't there to do anything.
Right.
So either that, or even if they didn't have the staff at the right size, they are in the right area and they're just digging everywhere at that point. Yeah. So they would have eventually found the Ark.
Would have probably said, we should test this out before we take it.
Yeah.
And if anything, it's that German kind of, they talk about the Führer, like, he's like, this has to happen.
Yeah.
So you just do it.
Yeah, Hitler was way into this.
Yeah, so you just, this will be
find
done.
Find the Ark!
Yeah, find the Ark. And, yeah.
Is that the magic box?
My question about that, though, is the moment that Indy knows, like, I want to flip it back to Indy and his place in, I mean, really, the trilogy, quadrilogy, I guess. There's going to be a new film in 2020.
But, really?
Yeah, Indy 5.
He's so old.
Yeah, I know. The moment that Indy knows that there's god magic, to the rest of the world, he can't prove it yet. He doesn't have the Ark because it's in not a museum, but you know,
it's in a Radio Shack warehouse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in the four films where he's portrayed Indiana Jones, physics has basically gone batshit. It's God, flaming hearts, God again, telepathic crystal aliens. At what point does he need this to be brought to like the global collective? I mean, what else is magic?
Basically, right. He just like internalizes all
overnight.
This.
Yeah, he just goes full stop. I don't need to tell politics or news. Hey, we freed those children from slavery, and it was blood mind control.
Well, and also more specifically, it's not just like burning hearts and shit. It's like other gods. So he's basically learned like all religions are true and correct.
Aliens too,
and aliens also.
Well, I would say like his failed relationships. His horrible relationship with his father, all of his like run-ins with the supernatural. I think it's safe to say Indiana Jones is very good at compartmentalizing.
I think you're right about that. So it's just like a deep psychosis.
He just stops thinking about it immediately.
Yeah, this like, I can put this under that rug and it'll stay there.
So when he's teaching to like the love. Like, love you, girl.
Yeah.
Like, he's just flippantly throwing in, so then the blood magic happens, and they're all like,
well, he's like, that's why he's messing around with teenagers and stuff like that, because he's like Rick from Rick and Morty. He knows that none of this shit matters. Like, he's like, this doesn't matter. Like, I can do whatever I want. Like,
it belongs in a museum.
Yeah, like he's really, well, that's my other, like, I think he's hardcore about that because you see that he and Marcus Brody clearly have this arrangement worked out, right? Where he runs off and steals, he robs graves. Sure. Like he's breaking international law, comes back and then can immediately just give him the Marcus, who gives him some money so he can put it directly in his museum.
Right.
And Indiana Jones is clearly like a little on the young side to be like a tenured professor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
how old would you say Indiana Jones is in Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Mid 30s.
Yeah, 35.
Okay.
He's been doing it for,
I think he was 37 at the time that movie came out.
All right.
Yeah. We know Marion predates for 10 years. So yeah.
So either Marcus Brody has like substantial like blackmail dirt, maybe he's got him and Marion or something.
Or the first girl.
the I Love You girl. Or Indy has like some rampaging addiction that he has to maintain.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So like Marcus is clearly taking advantage of this. Well, this guy desperately needs money, so I'm just going to send him off to steal shit for my museum.
He's like,
I'll give him a professorship.
Yeah, maybe I'll
kind of keep him under my wing. He's my mercenary. Like,
yeah,
I need
a heroin adventurer.
Just the Indiana Jones theme playing, shooting up in the back somewhere. It's a lot of heroin in today's episode.
Sure. It's a really good point. I mean, where does Indy get all this money anyway? I mean, like, at the end.
Gets it from Marcus, I guess.
I mean, the G-men are like, this agreement works for you. And like, we still don't like that it's not going into a museum. But, okay.
Hey, I've never wondered that before then, like. That little gold statue that he switches out with the sand.
Yeah.
Why did that belong in a museum?
Because it's history.
Why did it not deserve to stay where these people left it?
Yeah, like that's like the eternal argument of museums.
You know, like if the Nazis stole a whole bunch of artifacts and like burned down the buildings that they were in, and you know they have all that art, and still like to this day there's like art being found that like Nazis confiscated and stuff like that, and the places where that art lived like has gone away, then yeah, it belongs in a museum,
right?
But these things that are still sitting where they've been like worshipped or left or paying homage to whatever god they are for whatever culture he's infiltrated, why does that belong in a museum?
That's like cultural
appropriation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's like an actual like contemporary argument that is like happens now. Like there are communities that are like will endlessly petition museums being like, hey, give that back to us because that was like taken by some white dipshit to a museum in America. It belongs here in the culture where it is from. It, like, let us put it in a museum here. Right. Like, why do you heck get to have it?
So we've talked about how the movie was made and how some things are problematic. We'd like to talk about whether or not this movie should go on the gold record we send into space.
Yeah, ultimately, do we show this to aliens?
I'm going to start off, yes, I say. It shows that we have a propensity of like propagating our own history as a virtue. We learn from our mistakes, and we vilify the darkest part of our history, you know? That shows intellectual growth. We learn from a collective history and are able to make heroic those that want to salvage and save our past. I think they like that. There's this Carl Sagan quote, actually. They will marvel at how vulnerable the repository of all our potential once was, how perilous our infancy, how humble our beginnings, how many rivers we had to cross before we found our way. I like to think that they honor that, Tom.
I say, you show it to aliens because the series shows that God magic is true and powerful, and that we have powerful God magic to use against them.
it's like a very subtle warning, like shot over the bow.
Yeah. Like,
hey, we got this shit around.
It's like subtle intimidation.
Right.
I love how I do this deep dive into the philosophy, and you're just like, nah, man, we got a big gun.
It's like, got a big gun, bro. That's all knife.
So yeah, I was about to say, it's like showing somebody your knife collection. Yeah.
Like, Dan, what do you think? Do you have an answer to this question?
But whether or not we should show it to aliens?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily
have
to be.
I would say, like, in context, yes. Like, how we talked about it being, like, an homage to, like, so many earlier films, I think that it's a good form of, like, showcasing, at least American, in an American sense, like, our entertainment of what we find, like, to be fun, like, that old swashbuckling, you know, adventure story. But on the other hand, it highlights a lot of, like, anything with Nazis is like just shows like how evil we can be as people.
Anything with Nazis.
And then I wanted to say, but it shows another side to that because of...
It's nuanced.
Yes, because of, you know, Indiana Jones is... He shares none of those qualities and wants to do what's right, but then we just really broke down how what he's saying is right might not be, like, the best thing. When he, to right. him, right is, like, taking other people's artifacts and putting them in a museum.
Right, right.
So, I might have to say no.
That's a valid answer.
There is
an answer.
There is an.
It's a good movie. I love it.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but I don't know if I want it to represent.
Yeah, it's difficult because we're talking about whether to show it to him as a piece of entertainment, but it's also like the subtext of being like, this is a document of humanity.
Yeah.
This is what we think.
I always, as always, will take the side that there is the additional argument that anyone can make at any time, which is maybe they don't understand movies and just movies will scare them.
That's true.
They don't understand what this is.
What is this? So we're done here. We want you to know how you can talk to us via social media. First off, thanks for listening, and check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at Cracked Movie Pod. On Facebook, we're facebook.com/CrackedMoviePod. We've been Abe, Tom, and Dan. Dan, do you have any thing you want to plug before we go?
Sure. I'd love to tell people to check out my podcast that I co-host alongside the Sklar Brothers. It's called Dumb People Town. It's on Feral Audio. That drops every Tuesday. And then I have my own show, Hindsight, which I have people in the entertainment industry, comedians, writers, directors. They bring three photos from any chapter of their life, and we just talk about the context of their life when that photo was taken. It drops on Thursdays, Throwback Thursday. Oh, and people listen to the show and then see the photos or vice versa, whatever suits them. You can follow me at Daniel Van Kirk on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And yeah, I'm just doing stand-up shows around the country. I'll be on the East Coast this summer, the 208 Festival in Boise, Idaho. As well awesome. Other stuff. Just at Daniel Van Kirk, you can keep up with all those things. And thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for doing it.
Yeah.
It's great having you here.
We've been honored that you joined us.
Yeah, Dan will absolutely have you back when we do Stand By Me.
Thanks. Or Airborne.
Yeah, Airborne.
Man, we're Devil's Backbone all day, guys.
Yeah, we're doing a month on Airborne, baby. All right. Thanks for listening, and carry on, movie lovers.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.